about so what is obfuscation? So I guess if you look in the dictionary, the meaning of that word to us non-native English speakers is to make something less clear and harder to understand intentionally. So usually that's supposed to be a bad thing, so there's a negative connotation with the idea of obfuscation. But for us in computer security, that we're going to actually think about it as quite a positive thing. It's going to be a great tool for security. So in particular, what we're interested in is program obfuscation. So what do I mean by program obfuscation? We start, let's think of P as a piece of code. It might be source code or executable code, but something you could run on a machine. And we are interested in taking this program and changing it, obfuscating it, so going through a transformation. This is going to be, say, a probabilistic transformation. So there might be lots of possible outcomes to this transformation. But the key point is that you start with a program P, you end up with another program, obfuscated P, where the input-output behavior of the obfuscated program is exactly the same as P. So you haven't really changed what the program does. But what you have done is you made it impossible to understand. Okay? So whereas P might be a wonderful program where someone who took all the software engineering courses and was following the rules, and a lot of comments and formatting and identifier names and so forth, when you look at obfuscated P, you can run it, but you have absolutely no idea what's going on. This is a very vague intuition, but we will define this, of course, as we go on. So that's what program obfuscation is about. And it turns out that it's people are very interested in practice. So even though this is a field institute and it's mathematics, it's supposed to be a mathematics talk, there will be a lot of actually practical orientation for this talk in the basic sense of motivation. So in practice, so the main place that obfuscation has been, people have been interested in obfuscation is in copy protection. So for example, suppose you have a program that you want to make sure that only the privileged people who paid for it will run it, then you might put a condition in the beginning of the program saying, if a certain test fails, then don't let this program execute, otherwise let it run. So what could be the test? Maybe that the person who's running it knows some kind of password, or maybe that they can identify that it's running on the right kind of hardware, or whatever. Okay? Now, if this program really looked this way, then what you could do is just look at the code and take out exactly this test and run the program without any limitations. However, if the program was obfuscated, then you know there's some place in the program there's the test, okay, which will disallow you from running it if you're a thief, say, or you don't pass the test, but there's no way you can find it so as to remove it. So obviously, if you can obfuscate code in the sense that it becomes impossible to understand, then this is a way to get copy protection. Okay, so more generally, essentially these days, when a lot of code is written in Java, which is very easy, by looking at Java code, it's extremely simple to get the bytecode. It's extremely simple to get the source code. And often what's happening is it comes to your browser, the code is there, and you can just look at it. Then more and more people who design code would like to write it in such a way that even though you can look at it, okay, at the source code, you really, again, can't reverse engineer. So as to find out really the tricks of the trade or how this code actually works. Another place that apparently industry people are interested in obfuscation is in the online gaming industry. So apparently in games, kids or not kids or whoever is playing in those games want to get some kind of advantage in the game, you know, to win. And the more you know about the game, if you could figure out the code, you can figure out, where the prize is. And I have a son that's all he does. No, he doesn't try to figure out the code, unfortunately. He just plays. Maybe that would be good. He just plays the game. So there's a lot of them out there. Clearly, the companies that are selling more and more versions of the game would like to make it impossible for these gamers to gain an unfair advantage and, you know, beat everybody out. Especially when a new version comes out. Apparently, you know, these new versions are a bit different than the old versions, and the big game is to find the entry points. Where are the differences between the two versions? Okay, so people in the gaming industry are interested in obfuscation. It also has some relation to software watermarking. Spammers want to obfuscate as well. So these are sort of the good guys, right? They're trying to protect their software. Spammers are the bad guys. They want to send us mail so that we don't know that it's from them. So they want to obfuscate the fact that it's from them. So it's being used both as a security tool and also as a security hazard. They're bad, but they're legal. Okay. Well, actually, you can buy off-the-shelf obfuscators out there. If you go to Google or you go to your computer store, there's lots of these, packages that you could just sort of pay for and run. But the question is, of course, how good they are and what they do. So what they do is what you think they do. They do things like they take out comments, they remove formatting, they scramble the identifier names, they add redundant code so you don't know what's redundant, what's not redundant. They make it so that the program is unintelligible. So if you look at this piece of code, it looks better than this one. In the sense that I can understand something over here, but I certainly can't understand anything over here. Okay, so how good is this? So I can't tell what's going on, but perhaps, your son or daughter can tell what's going on. So apparently, even the word on the street is that these obfuscators are not very effective. So this is one of my students found this in some blog by Yahoo. And it says, then finally, there's the question of code privacy or code obfuscation. This is a lost cause. There's no transformation that will keep a determined hacker from understanding your program. This turns out to be true for all programs in all languages. It's just more obviously true with JavaScript, what I mentioned before, because it's delivered in source form. The privacy benefit provided by obfuscation is an illusion. If you don't want people to see your programs, unplug your server. Okay. So, and moreover, I think Yael, she was interviewing, my co-author, and she was interviewing Microsoft and IBM, and Microsoft and IBM both have a whole division that deals with program obfuscators. And she said that in Microsoft, she asked them, so how are you doing? They have a whole division. What's a good obfuscator? So they said, if a code goes out and it's not broken within 24 hours, then it was a good obfuscator. And then she says she went to IBM and she asked them, and they said if it's not broken in 2 weeks, it's a good obfuscator. So she said, well, in Microsoft, they said 24 hours, you guys are doing better. She said, yes, but honestly, nobody's looking at our code. So in any case, people apparently sell these obfuscators. At the same time, everybody realizes they don't work that well. Okay. And the question and this actually comes to my talk, so the question really is, indeed, is this the case? So in practice, this seems to be the case, but maybe we can do something here. Maybe if we define this properly and we use all our knowledge, cryptographic knowledge or otherwise, we could actually prove them different or not. Okay, so the focus of my talk and this work is a theoretical study of code obfuscation, essentially sort of three things that we're going to look at. How should it be defined? When is it possible? When is it impossible? And this theoretical investigation began before us. There was a work by Hada in 2000, and then a very well-known work by Barak, Goldreich, Impagliazzo, Rudish, Sahai, Vadan, and Yang in 2001. And I, in fact, will start to talk with the definition they provided. So there is a definition for what it means, theoretically speaking, to obfuscate a program, and that's where we'll start. We will change the definition during the talk and show some other results. But it's actually a fascinating field because there's a lot of open questions here. So what we show mostly, as you will see, sort of bad news. But I think that there are good news to be seen, except not in this talk. Well, maybe a direction. Okay, so what is the definition of obfuscation, the theoretical definition that this paper by Barak et al., I'm not going to say the name again, the talk will be very short every time I mention it. This is how they define it. They say, first of all, they're not talking about a single program because it won't be interesting, of course, to obfuscate a single program. So we're talking about a family of programs or a class of programs. So we say a class of programs, script C, is obfuscatable. So if you like to have something concrete in your mind, we could think of this class of programs, since this is a cryptography year, it's a class of RSA encryption. And each member of the class has a different key, different RSA key. So we would say that a class of programs is obfuscatable if there exists an obfuscator, that's that op from before, now it's just an O. So it's a procedure that takes program C and gives you another program, obfuscated C, with the following three properties. First of all, we want to preserve functionality. Right? So we want to make sure that for every X, C on X is the same as the obfuscated code on X. Second of all, we want to preserve performance. So that wouldn't be too good, if we took a program that runs quickly and we made it into a program that never stops running. or that's very slow. So I want to, what do I mean by that? Let's say that we allow even polynomial slowdown, which maybe in practice is not reasonable, but for our theoretical definition, that's fine. And the thing that's hard to define, of course, is what do we mean by the fact that it's unintelligible? Okay, so what Barak et al. Proposed was to give what they call a virtual black box definition. What's a virtual black box? Yeah. Oh, that's a very good question. I'll show you the results will hold regardless, whether it is polynomial time or not, because there will be impossibility results. But naturally, it would be better if the obfuscator was an efficient procedure. I'm willing even to live with an obfuscator that's a slow procedure. I think theoretically it's an interesting question to ask. Could you even take a long time and then produce an obfuscated piece of code? But clearly, in practice, what you need, in practice, in the instance, really solve the right question is to make the obfuscator an efficient procedure. Okay, so how are we going to define the fact that we want it to be totally unintelligible? So this is what they propose. They say, let's consider deterministic properties of the program. So what I mean by that is just a function pi that goes from the code to 0, 1. This is 0, 1 property. So it could be whether the first bit in the program is 0, which seems to be an uninteresting piece of information, but it could be something more interesting than that. Let's say, what's the bit of a secret that program is holding in it? Okay, so in any case, let's just think of any property of the original code. And what I want is the following, that to say the following. If there's an adversary, okay, who gets his input, the obfuscated code, okay, and tries to compute this property, so he's trying to figure out something about the original program, okay, then I claim that there's another adversary, okay, so it's a little modified, maybe it's a little more evil, but this guy is polynomial time and so is this one, okay, so I'm saying if there's an adversary who can work with the obfuscated code and figure out something about the property, then there's another adversary who doesn't actually need the obfuscated code. All they need is black box access to the program, and he will figure that property with the same probability, essentially. So in other words, I'm saying whatever you could do with the obfuscated code is worthless. You could have done it if you just had a black box and fitted inputs and get back outputs. Okay. So formally, just put all these like quantifiers here, and you say for every, I didn't say, but for every efficient, for every probabilistic one-time adversary A, that's the first, you know, evil guy, there exists another evil guy, such that for all of the programs in the family, for all the properties, the predicates that you want to learn, the probability that the first adversary, given the obfuscation, can figure it out is roughly the same, except for some exponentially small amount, than the probability that the other evil guy could figure it out, where the other evil guy just knows the size of the program, okay, and has black box access. So I'm just capturing here what I drew. Any questions? This is one definition. It doesn't have to be the only one. But that's the one that they propose. It has something very strong flavor to it. This would be wonderful to achieve, which I will convince you in a minute why that's going to be so wonderful to achieve. But so just remember this, that I wanted the obfuscated program is essentially equivalent to a black box. So before we talk about whether it's possible to obfuscate programs or not, in general, or maybe there are interesting programs that you can obfuscate, I want to just say that even though in practice people usually talk about obfuscators for preventing reverse engineering, okay, it turns out that if we could obfuscate the way that I just defined, okay, then it's actually a fantastic tool even just for cryptography. So not just for reverse engineering, but for standard cryptographic problems. So it turns out that many of the cryptographic problems that are still open actually can be cast as have a very, very simple solution if you could obfuscate in general. Okay, there's kind of an immediately beautiful solution if indeed you could obfuscate. So let me give you some explanation for the statement, because this really explains why obfuscation is not just interesting in practice, but it should be interesting really to the cryptographic community. So I claim that these, for example, all can be solved trivially if we knew how to obfuscate programs. One of them is computing on encrypted data, using any secret key cryptographic primitives in a public key setting, delegation of cryptographic ability. I'll show you, I'll spend a few more minutes on these. But essentially, my message is that if you could obfuscate, you could just sort of, in some sense, we're out of a job for these tasks at least, because there's a trivial solution. And that's good, because we have, we want to simplify our life. Of course, it would be a nightmare too, okay, because, hackers could obfuscate not only spammers, but they could obfuscate viruses, for example. They could send you a program, and you would have absolutely no way to be able to tell whether this program is is actually malicious code. But there's actually an interesting point, if I remember, I'll say in the end, where obfuscation can even help to battle this in some weird, bizarre way. Anyway, so let me convince you how, if we could obfuscate, I'm not saying we can, but if we could, we could solve cryptographic problems. So here's a cryptographic question. I'd like to design a program, okay, that takes as input ciphertext. So that's C1 is the encryption of some M1, some data M1, C2 is the encryption of some data M2, and where I'd like to have some program that what comes out, okay, is not the M1, not M2, but somehow some computation, some G computation on M1, M2, encrypted. Okay, why is that good? Well, lots of examples can be cast as such a thing. For example, you could think of these M1, M2, and so forth as votes, and what comes out is the tally of the votes, or you could think of them as votes that come out in certain order. What comes out is a random shuffling of the votes, which is a primitive that's used actually in electronic voting schemes that people are proposing. So they come out in a certain order, but they come out completely shuffled, and they you're encrypting the same votes, but you can't tell. They don't look like the same encryptions, and they're in shuffled order, so you can't no longer trace who voted in the third position. Okay. In any case, another example is, suppose that what G is doing is essentially profiling or filtering. So you think about G could be just looking for keyword search in the data M1 and the data M2, but I don't want to really give you my data. I want to give you my data encrypted, and I'm willing to run it through a filter that will figure out if there are keywords there or not. So also, this is another special case of this input-output transformation for the correct G. Okay, so I hope that these examples are enough to convince you that it's a very useful thing to do. However, we don't know how to do this. So we have encryption schemes which are called homomorphic, so they can add, let's say, M1 and M2. We have encryption schemes which are homomorphic in the sense they can multiply, but we don't have a fully homomorphic encryption scheme where you can do sort of a full set of operations. So it would be nice if we could, for every G, for every computation G, to be able to do that. That's an open question. However, if we can obfuscate, we solve this problem immediately. Why is that? Because I write a simple program. Okay, my program knows the secret key, knows how to decrypt E. So what it does is decrypt E, finds out what M1 is, what M2 is, then does the computation in a straightforward way. If it's tallying up the votes, just adds up the vote, then encrypts the result, and does an output. So that's a simple program, but wait a second, that's not an obfuscated program. If you look at this code, you can tell what the secret key is. But if I could obfuscate, I just write this code, and then I obfuscate it, and I give it to you. And now, since we have that black box guarantee, you have code which you can run, which does this functionality, and you learn nothing else. Yes? Okay. What's another thing we could do? All right. So another thing is transformation of what we call secret key to public key cryptography. So you're probably aware that there's something called secret key cryptography. That's when all the participants know some shared key. Okay, and that enables them to do some cryptographic operations. Public key means, in some sense, there are privileged parties who know the secret key, and everybody else only has a public key. Okay, it's much easier to design cryptography, both signatures and encryption and other things, in the secret key world. Okay, it's much harder in a public key world. If you could obfuscate, you could essentially transform any solution you have in a secret key world, you could immediately get a solution in the public key world. So in particular, something that a lot of people use are called cryptographic hash functions H. They don't have to be H, but I call them H. And what do I want from H? I want two things. One is that nobody can tell H from a random function. What does that mean? That means that if you show me HX, it looks totally random to me. Of course, if I know X, then it doesn't, because the second requirement is that you can evaluate H of X for yourself. So a hash function is this magical thing that you can evaluate it. However, if somebody gives you data, which is H of X, H of Y, H of Z, you can't tell that from random. Okay? Now, it's a nice thing to have, except we don't have it. So we have SHA-1, MD5, there's all these concrete proposals for hash functions that people have been using out there and are broken these days. And then there's more concrete proposals. They will be broken, I assume. Not by me, but by someone. However, so that's sort of a public key primitive, because we want everyone to be able to compute H. Okay. And yet, somebody else computed, I can't tell it apart. But what we do have is something that comes from the psychoq world, which is the following theorem with Goldreich and Mikali, which says the following, that if one-way functions exist, like RSA or discrete log or one-way functions in general, then you have something called pseudorandom function collections. What are these? These are functions where you can, again, they have the same kind of requirement that you want from a hash function. You cannot tell apart the value of f evaluated in x from random, okay? But you can evaluate it if you know a secret key. So the reason why this is not really an H is because in order to evaluate it, okay, you need to know some extra secret key information. Whereas with the H, I wanted everyone to be able to evaluate it. And what happens down here is once you know the secret key, yes, you can evaluate, but it doesn't look random anymore. Again, if I could obfuscate, going back to the topic of this talk, then I could immediately take these beasts, okay? I could then obfuscate them, and that would become exactly what the people want in the hash for the hash function. Because in a black box now, the secret key would be hidden, so I could always evaluate this function without knowing really what the secret key is, and yet the input-output behavior would look like a pseudorandom function. So I'm taking a long time, and I'll go back to obfuscation in a minute. Last reason why we want to obfuscate. And this reason actually is going to run throughout the talk, so it's so I will go through it. So suppose we have Alice here, and she has a signature scheme. Okay, so she has a secret key, FK and PK. FK enables her to sign. She's the only one who knows how to sign, but other people can verify maybe because they see her public. But she wants to go on vacation, and she wants Bob, her assistant or whatever, to sign for her when she's gone. So one thing she could do is she could give him her secret key. However, Bob, you know, after the vacation, he still can sign because he has a secret key. So that's not so good. So what Alice does is she takes her signature algorithm and she writes a little remark there. She says, only sign during October 05 when I'm on vacation. Okay? So Bob, he says, oh, that's very nice. After October, he takes out the line. However, if we can obfuscate, what Alice does, she writes that provision, she obfuscates, she gives it to Bob. So you can see that any cryptographic ability can be delegated this way. You just write the secret key in there, you write your provisions, you obfuscate. Very good. And we will come back to this example. So now that I think I've, you know, amply motivated, is it possible? All right, so first I'll tell you what was known before this work, and then I'll tell you about this work. So on the negative side, the paper by Barak et al., where they introduced the definition of the virtual black box, showed that was really the, you know, sort of the big thing, is that not only they defined it, but they actually show that there exists some class of functions which cannot be obfuscated. So there is some class of programs, if you like. I'll call them functions or programs, such that there is no way, efficient or inefficient actually, coming back to your question, Steve, there is no way to transform the code so that at the end it's unintelligible but still preserves the functionality. Now, this class of programs that they came up with was kind of a weird class of program, designed purposely, of course, to get the result. Now, what was the idea? We could, in some sense, say it in a line. So what they said is, here's a function that no matter what you do to it, if you take a program for this function, and no matter how you mess it up, you still will be able, from looking at the obfuscated code, to do more than black box. Okay, what was the idea? So it's a function that what it does is, it takes itself as an input. Okay, if it gets itself as an input, it outputs a secret. So if it gets a short program as an input that does exactly what it does, then it outputs a secret. But otherwise, it always says zero. Well, obviously now, if you have obfuscated code, okay, and you feed it to yourself, now I'm getting the condition and I output the secret. But if I only have black box access, I cannot feed it into myself. That's the key idea. You have to overcome this technical question of how can a program, you know, take itself as input in terms of sizes, and that's a lot of the work is about, because we're talking about fixed size inputs. Okay, but that's the main idea. Now, what does that mean? It means, in fact, that you cannot always obfuscate. So if one hoped that would be the case, that's not the case. However, he does not rule out that, you know, natural functions can be obfuscated. Because after all, who really wants to obfuscate this program that takes itself as input and otherwise just outputs zero all the time? Well, Barak et al. Do, but nobody else does. No, but seriously, so that's not exactly a natural computation. So possibly you could still obfuscate important things, or maybe all important things. In particular, maybe there exist encryption algorithms, digital signature schemes, pseudorandom functions that can be obfuscated. You know, and therefore we can solve all these, could get all these nice things we claim we could get, like delegation and so forth. In fact, on the positive side, it was also known that there are particular programs that can be obfuscated. Okay, so let me tell you what those programs are. Everybody with me? So I'm using that word obfuscate all the time. Hopefully everybody sort of in your mind you know exactly what that means, but that you can also get obfuscated. So in any case, here are the, and I'm not kidding, but these are really the two things that are known, or were known before our work. The first, both of them are sort of access control functions. So what do I mean? The first one I call the password function. What's a password function? It's a very simple function, iPassword, such that if you give it the, it takes actually an argument, okay? So it takes as input a string. If the string is equal exactly to a password, to a particular string, then it gives you a secret. Otherwise, it says zero. So it's like when you log in, there's only one password they will take. Otherwise, they don't let you in, okay? Well, it turns out that this piece of code, you could, you know, transform it into another piece of code that will perform it the same. I could give it to someone else, somewhere else, in Yahoo, or in eBay, or whatever, so that whenever I come in and give my password, it would let me in. And yet, by looking at the code, you know, you can't learn anything else. In particular, you can't learn the password. Okay? So this can be done. And moreover, and then furthermore, there's work by Dodis and Smith, and then some extensions of it that says that not only just password functions, but what I would call approximate password functions. So that is, you will let you in if X not only is exactly the password, but it's close to it. And they talk about biometric data, where there's sort of all kinds of measures of what it means to be close. Okay, so also this kind of thing can be obfuscated. So these are very nice results. They're under some cryptographic assumptions, like one-way functions of a certain kind and so forth, which is okay with me. In some sense, the state of the world we are with respect to obfuscation is that any computational assumption that's reasonable, that will allow you to obfuscate, would be a very interesting result. Okay. Then later you can talk about making it a better and better assumption, you know, making it sort of less and less difficult to believe. But at this point, we don't even have a computational assumption that we can make to show how to obfuscate. And these two functions, the passive function and the proximate passive function, you can. Having said all that, if you think about what these functions do, really what the obfuscator's goal challenge here was to obfuscate data, not computation. So in some sense, here, what you had to hide is the password, which is just a piece of data. Because what happens with the first function is that when X comes in, you compare X to the password. So it's just the data that you obfuscated. And similarly here. Okay, so it's not really that they've, in some sense, in either one of these results, have kind of tackled the challenge, can you obfuscate computation? Okay, so these are programs, and in some sense, all they do is sort of hide data, and then they compare what comes in to the hidden data. And that challenge still has not addressed here. Okay. All right, so essentially now we get to our work. So we have the status here, and unfortunately what we'll show is that lots of functions belong in the unobfuscatable category. So it's not just that contrived function, but it's some other contrived function. No, it's a much larger class of functions, okay, rather than a single one. And functions that really capture natural tasks, and in a sense, that's what I'll talk about today. But there's some good news about this result, I think, because it really does show that you have to look elsewhere, that you have to sort of leave the standard model of programs, and then maybe we can do something. And I'll talk about that at the end. All right. So the outline of the talk then now is that the first thing we're going to do is we're going to take that definition that I gave with the black box. And I'm going to make it even stronger. So I claim that definition, even though it seemed very strong, that the program looks like a black box, is not really strong enough. So there's something that I'll call multiple obfuscation attacks. In a minute, I'll explain it, which would come up in applications all the time, where even if you could obfuscate the way that Barak et al. Defined, you really, it's not good enough. So first of all, I'll strengthen definition, and then I'll show that these natural classes of functions cannot, that there exist lots of natural class of functions which are not obfuscatable using the new definition. Okay, so I'm making it stronger. With respect to the stronger one, I'm showing lots of functions cannot be obfuscated. And then if we have time, I'll talk about what the conclusion really is, how to go outside the model. Okay. So what's let's first strengthen the definition. So I want to explain, show you an attack, okay, and that to illustrate that definition was not strong enough. So what's the attack? So let's go back to the delegating signature example. So again, Alice, you know, very happy. She says, ah, you gave me an obfuscator, and it's an obfuscator that obeys the Barak et al. Definition. So she says, now I'm fine. I can go on vacation quietly, and I give Bob the obfuscated restricted program. However, then she wants to take a vacation in November as well. So she says, all right, no problem. I know how to obfuscate the program. This time I'm saying he can only sign during November. Okay. However, the definition that Barak et al. Gave, does not rule out learning something about the program if you're getting, let's say, two obfuscated versions of the program. And in fact, in some sense, our proof showing impossibility will show, we'll kind of work with this idea, showing how if you're getting two obfuscated versions of a program, of the same program here, then you could do something like extract the secret key. Okay? So there is nothing that rules it out, and in fact, if you look at it, you can see that if you get more copies of an obfuscated program, you could actually get a lot of information. That's not good. Okay, so what are we going to do? Well, I guess one remedy is you would say, well, Alice, don't obfuscate twice. But that's not too good. And especially it's not good is because, you know, this doesn't necessarily depend on Alice. Because in this particular example, these two programs were the same, they were very similar programs. Okay, so they certainly were dependent on each other. But it could be that even if Alice sort of said, all right, I'm just going to obfuscate once, there could be some Carol who has a completely independent program in the class, so completely different key. So she has her own secret key chosen at random, maybe even a different cryptographic function, and she obfuscates it. Okay? And sends it to Bob or has it on the internet somewhere. Then I claim that even in such a case, when these programs are independent of each other, it is possible that Bob will be able to compute some information, some secret, which he wouldn't have been able to compute if he was just given one copy. So in other words, we need to change the definition, or we're going to change the definition in any case, to address this. And the definition is going to be essentially to design obfuscators which are secure with respect to what we call auxiliary input. Okay, so what's auxiliary input? It's something, I'll say in a minute more formally, but essentially we want to say that the obfuscation looks like black box even if there's some other information around, even if there's some other auxiliary input available to Bob. Okay, it could be an obfuscated program, it could be other things. Okay, and this is something that was actually done in the context of zero knowledge, where you had very similar kind of definition, where the bad guy wasn't getting an obfuscated program, but he was just getting proof of a statement. Okay, and you were saying that just saying the statement or giving the zero knowledge proof of a statement were the same. Okay, and that was true even when some auxiliary information Z was present. Okay, so let's go back to obfuscation. So what do I mean about strengthening definition? Whoops. I mean the following. So this was the old definition, okay? And now I'm saying, you know what, really I should consider the fact that, you know, the adversary could have some extra auxiliary information, like another obfuscated program or something, and I want to require that whatever you can compute from the code obfuscated and the auxiliary information could have been computed anyway just from looking at the black box, you know, input-output feeding in, and the same auxiliary information. So the fact that information is out there isn't going to disturb me. Okay, still, what's maintained is that the code looks like a black box. And now, of course, the predicate or the property you're trying to find might be a function of both the program and this auxiliary data. And we'll consider two types of auxiliary input, the kind where it's independent of the program and may depend on the program. So if you saw the example with delegation, this is sort of the harder case. This is the case where the two programs were actually the same program, slightly modified. Where this was the case where the programs were maybe completely independent of each other. All right. Now, dependent is easy to define. This dependent auxiliary input is easy to define. Essentially, we're saying that for every Z, this should be true. But how would we define independent? So the way that we sort of capture this independence is the following. Okay. Is as follows. We're saying that for every bad guy, there exists a worse guy, but not too much worse, still polynomial time, such that for every property that this guy is trying to compute, for all auxiliary inputs still, we want to capture all auxiliary inputs, the probability this time taken over the program. So this way we're capturing the fact that Z is chosen first. Z is chosen first and C second, so that's how I'm capturing independence. I'm saying that I want the probability over the programs of the bad guy, first bad guy computing the predicate to be about the same as the probability of the second bad guy computing the predicate, where the difference between the two bad guys is the first one has the obfuscated code and the second one has only black box. I forgot how you heat the place here. Truth is, in Israel, it's very cold inside, you know. I don't know, it's confusing because it's actually quite hot there. But at home, we're always walking around with blankets because it's freezing. Yes. Okay, where are we? Fine, so that's the definition of what we want about obfuscation with respect to independent auxiliary input. So in some sense, if you think about it, the Barak et al., they required for all programs, and I'm thinking of probability only programs, but I'm saying, in my opinion, this is actually a very natural definition, because if you think about the uses of obfuscation, such as the family is the family of RSAs, and you, by choosing a particular member in the family, that's like choosing a key at random, then it makes actually a lot of sense to talk about probability over these choices of programs in the family. Okay, so this is all definitions. Now what about the results? So now I'll show you sort of three things. First, that there exists classes of functions that cannot be obfuscated with respect to the dependent definition. Actually, this will be first. With respect to the independent definition. Then you would probably hope that there are more functions that cannot be obfuscated with respect to the dependent one, since that's a more stringent definition. And on the good side is at least we don't lose the positive results. So the positive results we have are still going to hold with respect to this strength in definition. Even though we strengthen definition, we haven't lost what's positive. It's actually one can show that if you could show a password function obfuscator, then it's also going to be an obfuscator with respect to independent auxiliary input. Not dependent, but independent. Okay. So let's talk about the first theorem. Okay, so first I'll say it informally because I need to define the objects. But there'll be these objects called filter functions or filter programs, which are not obfuscatable with respect to the independent auxiliary input definition. So let's see also how a proof looks like. But first I need to define what filter functions are. Okay? So what's a filter function? Okay. A filter function is the following. Take any function, okay? And I'll tell you what the filter version of it is. So a function or a program is that box there. And let's say the function usually just takes x and outputs f of x. That's the usual program. But I'm going to make it into a filtered version. What's a filtered version? Is that in addition to x, I want to have another input. And the input is some secret corresponding to x. So what do I mean by that? For example, you could think of, if you go back to signature delegation, is that Alice says, I'm going to delegate my signature, okay? I'm going to let my signature scheme work as long as, only, but it's only going to work if you can actually produce, whoever gives you X to sign, the document to sign, can also produce a signature on X of his own signature on X. So in other words, I will compute F of X for you if you can actually prove to me, by giving me this W, okay, that you know something extra, okay, about X. More formally, that would be essentially a witness for X being a member of some language. Okay? So another motivation here is, you know, there are these things called certification authorities. So supposedly we all have these public keys out there. And somebody, when somebody sends me a message, okay, they saw my public key on the web, how do they know actually that's my public key and not someone else's public key? Because there's supposed to be some certificate that says that my public key was certified by someone else, was certified by someone else, all the way up to some public key that you actually recognize as legal. Okay, so that's what sort of the idea of a certification authority is. Because in some sense, we have to trust that somewhere out there is authenticating some piece of information. So in any case, so this is another example. A trusted center could certify a public key only if it's given also the corresponding secret key. So you could think about this blue box as a certification authority and says, yeah, I'll certify your key, but you got to show me something else. All right. So now I told you what a filtered function is. And more formally, if we think about a class of functions, script F, and we take some language in NP, so that's sort of the where it's an NP because I want there to be a short proof that X is an L, then I will say that the filtered class is essentially F sub L, such that F sub L will compute the original F of X as long as you get, you know, a short proof that X is an L. because it's just a formal definition. I'm saying I could take a function, make it into a filtered function, f sub l, where what I mean by that is that I'll compute the original function if I always also get some witness that x is an l. Okay? All right. And now if we go back to the theorem, okay, now that we have sort of an idea of this definition, the theorem is, it says the following. The filtered functions c sub l are not obfuscatable as long as the following two conditions hold. Okay? So maybe I'll write that here. Okay. So c sub l are these filtered functions. So I'm saying c gives out c of x. Okay. If in addition there is this w coming in. Okay. But I claim that that these guys are not obfuscatable. Okay. If c is for c that's any encryption of function, or any signature scheme, or any pseudorandom function. Okay. So there's actually a more general condition, but I guess all I want you to the general conditions over here, and I'll clarify in a minute. The point is the following: c is a useful cryptographic function. Okay. So any c. Any of your, take your favorite encryption, digital signature, pseudorandom function, okay? I'm saying that cannot be obfuscated if I'm talking about a filtered version of it. Where the filter is, okay, that L is some NP-complete problem. In the proof, you'll see where that's necessary. So, again, these functions, where C is a completely natural function, any encryption, any signatures, any pseudorandom function cannot be obfuscated, okay, if you look at it, consider its filtered version. And the kind of witness I'm looking for is a witness for membership in some NP-complete language. Okay? We don't need the NP-completeness here because of any hardness condition, but just because of the completeness. In fact, the encryption function, the signatures, pseudorandom functions, that's just all examples of something more general. Okay, it's what I'll call that C has super polynomial pseudo entropy. I'll explain what that means in a minute. Here, let's just have a slide on that. So what I mean by that is the following. You know what a pseudorandom function, or you have some sense of what a pseudorandom function family is. That is, if I look at the function values, they look to me totally random. Okay, so I'll say that C is not a totally pseudorandom function, but it has pseudo entropy P if the following is true. That it's not true that if you evaluate C everywhere, it always looks random. But there's some subset, that's that red subset over there. There's some polynomial-sized subset, such that if you look at the value of C on x1, x2, up to xc, on that subset, it looks to you, or it looks to an adversary, so if you look at those values, they look to you really as if you're looking at sort of random values. In fact, it doesn't have to be totally random, but something that has minimum entropy. Okay, so I'm saying the function could be maybe a structured function, but it has some subset which the values on look random. Sort of random. And that's even true if you could query the function in other places. It's a terrible animation. Whatever. So I'm saying this guy, he could find out the function everywhere else. Still, on that red subset, he can't tell it apart from random. So going back here just for a minute. I guess if I go back to the theorem, I'm saying that as long as C obeys that definition, that requirement, plus something else we won't get into for the talk, then the class is unobfuscatable. Just to give some, you know, caption, what you have to remember about this definition is essentially that these kind of family of functions are the kind where if you just saw the value of the function, that it's hard, essentially, if somebody told you x1 and C of x1, x2 and C of x2, xn and C of xt, okay, it would be hard for you to come up with a small program that agrees, that essentially on x1 computes C of x1, x2 computes C of x2, and so forth. Okay, so there's something non-compressible about this thing. Okay, so these are the class of programs where if I gave you the data, you would be hard-pressed to find a program that computes, even though it does exist. So I'm saying those are the kind of programs that are not obfuscatable. If you think about it, they're very, very different than those passive functions. Remember, the passive function was just had, you know, on one value was, you know, had some meaning. Everywhere else it was a zero. These functions, on the other hand, they compute in something that has pseudorandomness in it. Okay, so should I do the proof or should we just keep going? Let's do the second proof. It's better. It's not as nice, but it's easier to follow. So second theorem. Okay. Second theorem says, all right, so first theorem said, so there's this class of, I think, more natural functions that cannot be computed, and certainly larger. The second theorem says, okay, what about dependent auxiliary input? Here, our hope was, okay, that we could show that nothing can be obfuscated, that anything that obeys this super polynomial pseudo-entropy is not obfuscatable. So any encryption algorithm, signatures, and so forth, but we couldn't prove that, but maybe one of you could prove it. We still have a condition. Okay, so I'll show you what the condition is in a minute. The condition is that this something called a point filter function, which I'll define in a minute, can be obfuscated. So it's very weird. I'm saying essentially nothing can be obfuscated if something else can be obfuscated. So if you show me this one family, it's going to have some sort of complete nature to it. If that thing can be obfuscated, then you can show everything else cannot. And this proof I will actually show you. In some sense, this is an impossibility result no matter how you look at it, because it says that either this thing can't be done, okay? So in other words, either you cannot obfuscate it, or if you could, then all of those guys cannot be obfuscated. All right. So what is this point filter function? So here's the function I'm saying. If you go home and you work on this for a while and you manage to obfuscate it, okay, and I don't think that's impossible, by the way. So we had some ideas that didn't work out. But there is something about this that maybe is possible. Then you would show a very large impossibility result. You would have a small conquest in some sense because you would show that everything else cannot. All right, so what is this point filter function? Well, in order to explain to it and also give you my feeling why I think that this should be able, why somebody could show an obfuscation for it, let's remind ourselves about the password function. So remember I said there was that one nice password thing that can be obfuscated? Well, what did that have? What was that? It was a program where you were looking for if you put the password in, then the secret bit would come out. Otherwise, it would always be zero. And this one we said, yeah, that's good. This one we know how to obfuscate. What if we change this password scheme to be the following password scheme? Now, what's hidden inside that belly is not a password. In fact, nothing is hidden. What's inside that belly is some statement, some public statement. If you think you think about it as a graph, some public graph, okay? And so what's the connection to password? I'm saying, you know what, I'm going to give you the secret, not if you're able to guess this public graph, because it's public, everybody can guess it, but if you give me let's say a three coloring of this graph, then I give you the secret. So in other words, I give you back a secret bit B if you supply me with a witness for X. So think of an example where X, the statement is, I'm a three-colorable graph, and W is the three-coloring. So you see? So again, I can think of this as a password scheme, but it's very different than the previous one. The previous one, really, there was just some data stored, and I had to show that I know the data. Now what's stored, in some sense, is a theorem, and I have to show that I know how to prove it. Okay? So when the program checks that I'm the right person, it doesn't check that I give them the right data. It checks that the data I give obeys some computation. So whatever obfuscation you're going to give for this will have to have some grain of the ability of obfuscating computation rather than just hiding data. Okay? All right, so in any case, this is what I call a point filter function, or more formally, again, I fix a language in NP, and I think of X as a member of this language, and my function now will give the secret only if you get a witness that certifies that X is in the language, and otherwise zero. Okay? So again, I want to sort of emphasize that this function always gives X out. X is not a secret. The statement, the graph, that's not secret. What's secret is really a witness. And, yeah. The secret is B, yeah. And the witness. That's not public, at least. Yeah, you're right. The secret that we're hiding, that will differentiate getting the right input from not, is B. I'm just saying that finding the right input amounts to finding a witness. Okay, so let's delta correspond to a family of these functions, for different x's and different b's. And the second theorem, which I will give you the proof, is that every class of circuit, again, that obeys that super polynomial through the entropy condition is not obfuscatable. So now we don't have any filtering. I'm just saying, so notice, I'm saying that actually now any circuit, any encryption algorithm, pseudorandom function, signatures, any, none of that is obfuscatable. If that condition holds, if for some NP-complete language, these strange password functions are obfuscatable. Okay. So again, you could think of it as an impossibility result either way, but I don't care. So let's see what a proof would look like. It's in an hour, right? So 5 more minutes. Excellent. I think you'll probably obfuscate up to where you want to be obfuscated at this point. But let's go through the argument. All right, so what do I need to show? I need to show that if this condition holds, so there's some NP-complete language, such as that delta sub L is obfuscatable, then everything is not. Okay, all the natural classes are not. Okay, so let's assume, in fact, that this condition holds, and there's some such NP-complete language. And the reason why I want it to be NP-complete, you see here, is because that would mean that for every L in NP, so that's sort of easy to show. So if you have a way to obfuscate this for an NP-complete problem, then it's going to be true for any, it can be obfuscated for every L. And now what do? I say, okay, let's fix it. Now we'll show. Let's take any class of programs with super polynomial pseudoentropy. And I want to show you that there's something that an adversary can learn if he looks at obfuscation, which he wouldn't be able to learn from black box. Okay? That's my goal, right? To show you that these things cannot be. I want to get an impossibility result. So I'll show you how you can learn something from code which you couldn't learn from black box. Okay. So the idea is going to be the following. I have to use auxiliary input. I mean, I introduced it. So far, I haven't used it yet, just in the statement of the theorem. And this is where it's going to come in. What I'm going to show now is a certain kind of auxiliary input that's going to give me the result. What's going to be this auxiliary input? This auxiliary input is, this is the idea. What Z is going to be is itself, just like an example of signature elongation, an obfuscated circuit. So it's itself going to be a circuit. Okay, it's going to be a program, not just going to be a string of bits. It's a program. And in fact, it will be an obfuscated one. In a minute, you'll see why I need that for the proof. But what is it, ignore that for a second. This program is the kind of the following kind of program. It has a secret bit in its belly, okay? And it outputs it only if it gets as input, okay, a small circuit that agrees with C on these x's. So these are going to be the x's on which C looks pseudorandom. So what's happened here? So what's happened here is the following. I claim the following. Look on the left. Yeah, look on the left. On the left, okay, I claim that this adversary has a very easy job of computing the bit B. Okay? Why is that? Because, why can't he do that? Because what he does is he takes Z, okay, Z just expects to get an obfuscation of the circuit. He feeds it an obfuscation of the circuit. Certainly, that obfuscation agrees with the original circuit. This is the same one on those values. And he gets back the bit. Okay? However, I claim the ugly guy over here, okay, he can't do it. Why can't he do it? Well, he has Z, okay, and he wants to do the same thing. He wants to feed it a code which agrees with the circuit C, okay, on these values. But he doesn't have code. He just has black box access. Not only doesn't have code, I claim that because what I gave him was an obfuscation of Z, okay, he really can do nothing else. That's why I needed Z to be obfuscated. So if Z wasn't obfuscated, maybe he could look in there and figure out something. But because it is obfuscated, and because the definition guarantees it, it really means that he cannot do better than outputting 0 or 1 at random. Okay, so there is a difference between the two of them. And the last thing to, of course, check is that how could this auxiliary input be an obfuscated circuit? Wait a second, I'm trying to show that obfuscation is not possible. How can I all of a sudden use as a tool inside of my proof obfuscating something? Well, that's where my condition comes in. Because essentially, you can express this particular circuit as one of those point filter functions. Okay, essentially, it's a function which will, why is that a point filter function? It's because I'm saying I could verify, there's an NP witness to the fact that the input here is a small circuit that agrees with x1 through xn. That's why it was important that it was a small set, because I want this NP witness to be short. Okay, so that's the end of the proof. You know, as many proofs are, it's a trick. But it works. Okay, so we're done with the impossibility. So those are the two impossibility results. And as I said, at least the definition the definition is such that positive results we have still hold with respect to the independent auxiliary input. What about respect to dependent? So it turns out there's the result of Canetti from 97, for those of you who are familiar with it, it still holds, but it has to strengthen the cryptographic assumption. The result of Wei from 2005 doesn't seem to hold with respect to our strengthened definition. So even though he has a proposal there, you know, once you strengthen the requirement, it seems to not to hold anymore. So we are, what is that? Work? I didn't mean that conclusion. I meant to say more work, but it has the same effect. Work. It's even better. Okay. Twice as much work. No. I didn't mean, I think I did that on the plane. Okay, so the conclusion slide. All right, so what's the conclusion? The conclusion is that it's kind of disappointing. You know, cryptography has been a fairly successful story. Always we sort of define these goals and then we achieve them. And here, you define the goal, you don't achieve it. I think what it means is that we haven't defined it right. I mean, that could be one meaning, that what we need is to relax the definition. Another thing it could mean is that we need to relax the model, that really if I just give you a piece of software, you cannot achieve complete obfuscation. Perhaps I shouldn't just give you the piece of software, but I should maintain some sort of leash. Okay, and the leash could come in the form of interaction, maybe having a small hardware device. I'll show you in a minute what I mean. And the second, of course, conclusion is you could continue to search for obfuscation in the regular model with the same definition, but for specific tasks, which are not don't fall under our results. And it turns out, actually, there is a whole class of new results from the last year or so where people have managed to obfuscate more than the password function. But they all look similar in the following sense. So I just want to, can I take 2 minutes just to finish off? So it seems there's a whole bunch of positive results which fall in the following mold. Where what the programs do, these are sort of programs, my God, which they take encrypted inputs, let's say input 1, input 2, etc., and they output encrypted outputs, where this is encryption under one encryption key and this is encryption under a second encryption key. So it's these programs that what they do is something very explicit. They decrypt the input, they do a computation, and then they encrypt the output under another key. Now, it turns out, why would people think of this? It's because these are useful programs. They're useful for mixed nets, this electronic voting. There's some sort of re-encryption task where you want one server has encrypted data, and he wants to pass it to someone else, encrypt it under their key. You can think of keyword search of encrypted data this way. So there are a whole bunch of examples that came out from different directions that all solve. Essentially, what they do is that they solve the obfuscation task for specific tasks. They always look as if the inputs are encrypted and the outputs are encrypted. So there's something about this format that enables encryption and that eludes the impossibility result. So it'd be nice to understand this further. What about relaxing the definition? So here's another definition with a student. It's different. Okay, so it avoids this black box paradigm. And here's just an intuition for what it is. I'm not going to get into it very long. Let's say the following. Okay, so you cannot black box obfuscate. Let's take that as a given. Turns out still people want to obfuscate out there. Okay, and they're doing so all the time. Could you define, possibly say, that I want to obfuscate as good as possible, the best possible? How would you define that? So one way to define that is to say, we'll say that an obfuscator is best possible if, okay, if you take any two programs that compute the same function, okay, and have the same size, then whatever can be learned from the obfuscated version, okay, could have been learned from any other program. So in other words, instead of saying that what you could learn from the obfuscated program, you could have learned from black box access. Okay, I'm saying black box access, maybe you learn less, okay? But I'm saying from this version, the obfuscated version, you can learn, whatever you can learn from that, you could learn from any program that does the input-output. Okay, so in other words, it's not this black box, you know, idle in the sky, but from any other program for the function. So this is, it turns out, actually a different definition, in the sense that we can show you programs where you, it's impossible to do them in the black box definition, but you could do it here. Unfortunately, they're not very interesting programs. So I'm not really going to push this definition. I'm just saying that there are ways to avoid the impossibility results from before and to still come up with something that's meaningful. But I think that maybe the most promising direction is to really talk about new models. Okay, that is not the standard software model where I give you the program and now you run with it but learn nothing. Okay, one model, maybe not so interesting, but that you could get results in is, and one can argue about whether it's reasonable or not, is what I call interactive obfuscation. Here, you think of the server, the someone who's selling the program, Microsoft, is that he gives you the obfuscated code, but this version of obfuscation doesn't let you really run it on your own. You need the help of Microsoft to run it in the following sense. In a sense, at the end, you have an encryption of the result, and let's say you'd need Microsoft to recover the result for you. I'm saying even to achieve this is not obvious how to do, because I want an extra requirement. And the extra is that I want, of course, Microsoft not to be involved, because you could just have Microsoft. You give it X, it computes the program, gives you back the result. No, this I don't want. I want to distinguish the server or Microsoft from the client. I want essentially that once I gave you the program, the bulk of the work is on you. So how would you define it? You may say I wanted the work that Microsoft has to do is sublinear in the size of the program. I'm saying this is a possible requirement. I don't know how to achieve it, but it would be an interesting result, I think. And finally, which I think is probably the most interesting question, which we actually do have results on, is this idea of a one-time program. So what's that idea? All right, so we can't obfuscate. So suppose what you could do is something else. I give you a program, okay, and it's not that now you can just compute it forever and learn nothing about it, but I timed this program. Time is the wrong word, but you'll see why I use it. I give you this program. You can now run it for one input, or let's say if I wanted in advance for 100 inputs. You choose the input. So you choose X1, you compute the program on X1, X2, up to X100. I have no idea what they're going to be. But after you run it for 100 times, the program ceases to exist, and moreover, I guarantee that you've learned only the value of the program on 100 executions. So in some sense, it's a limited obfuscation. On one hand, it's limited. On the other hand, it's kind of remarkable. How can I give you code that will stop it to exist? Okay, and it would have a lot of, value. If you could think of many applications that right now, software, once I give it to you, it's gone. You know, you have it. But this way, I'm not giving it yet forever. So some of the new work that we do is that we can show how to do this. Of course, there's, how they say, there's nothing from something from nothing. We have, what we need is that when I give you this code, actually it's with hardware. So there's a very simple, it's not a secure processor or something. There's some very simple gadget, okay? But still it's a piece of hardware that I give you with the code so that will enable you to run it once or run it 100 times. And after you've run it 100 times, you won't be able to run it anymore. And it's not one of these exploding Mission Impossible, but something very simple where, essentially you've given a bit, it outputs a string and it erases the second string. All right, so that's the end. Any questions? This was a computational model. So when I said for every my adversary, my ugly guy and then uglier guy, they were polynomial time. It's okay with me that you would break it. I actually wrote for all A to exist S, but I didn't qualify. Just said it in words. I only care about polynomial time, just like in the case of RSA. So you were absolutely right, but the definition did. That's what I defined. I just didn't say. Sorry, I want exactly what you're asking. Still, it's RSA. I know how to do it until someone factors. But with chapter of permutations, I know how to do it. And here, I have no proposal to even give you of how to sit down and do it, except for these simple functions, or for this other model. Yeah?
One of the motivations was you have a bit of code which is checking that you have the right to run the program. Just understand how that fits into this other model.
For the hardware?
Yeah.
Or the interactive? Oh, okay. Good point. So, okay. All right. Sorry. Let me try to make sure I understand your question. So, first of all, you're right that what these practical motivations, they don't exactly fit within what people were trying to do in theory. Because in some sense, when we have the black box definition, we're thinking about hiding information, right? Whereas all they care about is that you don't take that statement out. So that's what you're referring to. So of course, our definition would imply they can't do it, but you're saying maybe that's good enough. They can and guarantee theirs, and yet you'll find out lots of information. Is that?
So you're saying that the results imply
you cannot do that. No, if you could show they could obfuscate in the sense of a black box obfuscation, then you won't be able to remove that statement as well. That's for sure. However, it's true that it could be another definition that that solves that problem and doesn't solve all our cryptographic problems. That's good enough. I don't know. It makes sense, but I don't know how to define it. Yeah, I mean, that actually brings in something that I said I'll talk about. When I was in Cornell, Snyder asked me showed me a nice thing that they're doing. So he was saying that in fault-tolerant computation, okay, or let's say you have a program and somebody attacks it with a virus or some buffer overflow, you know that? Okay, so they manage to write over your data by running some clever buffer overflow, by running your program essentially with bad input. So his idea was that obfuscation could fight that. I'm getting to your point in a minute. And the reason why he said obfuscation was relevant for that, he was saying, well, you know what you could do? You could take your program, and then you could obfuscate it several times. And since obfuscation sort of changes the program, although it's the same input-output behavior, now whoever has bad input that manages to buffer overflow the original version, probably the same input isn't going to also cause that buffer overflow to all the obfuscated versions. So it sort of makes sense. You've taken the program, sort of scrambled it up, so its use of memory is going to be different. Okay, so even though one copy of the program can be attacked, the second one probably won't.
They say they do buffer overflow, but they can't exploit.
No, they can do buffer overflow in one copy, but not on another copy. Because buffer overflow... buffer overflow, I mean that you really know how the inputs are arranged in memory, so you know that you're writing over some important place where the program jumps back to and it destroys you whole. I happened to teach network security last year, so I got into this. So in any case, buffer overflow apparently is the only thing that interests people in the real world. In any case, what I'm saying is that here's an interesting use for obfuscation, okay? And the reason why it was related to your question is because the definition of virtual black box doesn't actually guarantee that what he wants to happen will happen. Because a virtual black box means that if you look at the code, you can't tell anything about the data. But it could be that the memory, you know, the way memory is aligned is exactly the same in all possible copies. So even though this definition is strong, it's not as strong as you would need for that application. And that in order to address that application, you need a definition altogether that might be good for that and yet doesn't hide information. So there is something that's true, that different tasks seem to require different definitions. And the definitions that we're giving are really tailored more to the cryptographic application. That was a long answer. You had a question?
In your possibility results, you require the language L to be MGP.
Right.
You don't require it to be MGP. You know that it's being set. Say it's suitable.
No, not at all. I think that, so again, I really didn't, I didn't need a P that would be different than NP for these results, okay? I mean, the fact that it was NP complete was just sort of for the expressive power, because I wanted to say that if it's NP complete, it means that for every language, it was somewhere there in the theorem. So the answer is no. Sure. Although with a different proof.
Okay.